The views expressed in this interview are those of the individuals and do not reflect the official policy or position of the U.S. government, the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, or the Naval Postgraduate School. Welcome to the Trident Room, brewer of stout conversation, unfiltered and on tap. On today's episode, host Trevor Mayfield goes below the surface with host Dan Peterson.
Hello, everybody. Trevor Mayfield here, and today we're talking to U.S. Navy Lieutenant Dan Peterson. And this episode is part of our Below the Surface series, where we actually interview our fellow podcast hosts to learn about their unique experiences as military professionals and their scholarly pursuits while they're here at Naval Postgraduate School. Dan is a naval meteorologist and oceanographer, and he's now a graduate student at NPS pursuing his Master's of Science in Meteorology and Physical Oceanography. So two quick points before we get into the podcast. Point number one, please give us a like, follow, subscription, leave a comment, etc. on whatever platform that you're listening to the podcast on, as that feedback helps us as the podcast hosts and here on the podcast team provide a better product, as well as that engagement just helps spread the podcast out to different platforms and get us new listeners. And second point, so like I said, Dan's a naval meteorologist and oceanographer, acronym known as METOC. We're not going to really get into like what is METOC, definition of METOC in this episode. We have plenty of episodes already in the podcast series. Definitely encourage everybody to check out episode 47 with our colleague, Lieutenant Colleen Wilmington, and episode 48 that Dan hosted. And I think Colleen was on that with you as well. Yeah, with Fleet Weather Center San Diego. So check those episodes out for more background generally on METOC. But you know, this episode's all about Dan, hear about his experiences and time here at NPS and the Navy writ large. So yeah, I'll stop talking. Dan, how you doing today, man?
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time. Definitely a little bit more nervous sitting on this side of the microphone, not asking the question. So, bear with me a little bit as we kind of go through this interview. So
yeah, grass is not greener. I'm always a nervous wreck before all these episodes doing my outlining. And then I skip a whole paragraph and I realize it 2 minutes later. So yeah, definitely glad we're on the podcast team. It's a cool experience to share with you, man.
Yeah, I think I appreciate the opportunity to kind of get different perspectives from students throughout the Naval Postgraduate School, their experiences, their backgrounds, because, you know, the Department of Defense is it's a large, you know, unit and a lot of diversity that goes into it. So I walk away that much richer for the experience every time we have a sit-down podcast meeting or we get an opportunity to do one of these interviews. So it's an amazing experience.
Yeah, speaking of diversity amongst services and diversity amongst military occupational specialties and things like that, this last week, me and Dan were actually part of War Game that was sponsored by the Marine Corps Warfighting Lab. They took two students here to kind of study how command and control structures would work in, you know, future generic conflicts. And Dan, a meteorologist and oceanographer, had a huge part in that. So Dan, like, what was your part in that War Game? Just, it's fresh in our mind, so I figured we'd lead in with that one.
Yeah, that's a great place to kind of jump in on background and diversity. So during the War Gaming, environmentals get a vote, and you know, our job is to try to express that through the War Gaming. If someone wants to make a specific move, you know, there may be some environmental impacts to consider when they're doing that, and especially with the C2 structure and understanding what possible disruptions are there from an environmental standpoint. So there's a lot of nuances that go into the War Gaming, and I think that's what impressed me the most, specifically with this War Gaming and the level of knowledge that all the players brought and the questions that were asked. They were unique, they were very specific, and you know, it took a great deal of effort for me to rely on all the different backgrounds that I've been through in the meteorology community to try to answer the mail on some of those. So really awesome experience.
Yeah, definitely an awesome experience for me as well. A lot of friction induced, that one problem you threw at us with the cyclone, that moving and talking was pretty challenging for that 10-hour period.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, as a weather guy, you always get to hear about, when negative weather impacts operations. The feedback is almost immediate. Very seldom do I get a, hey, Dan, it was a great sunny forecast today, you know. So, it's one of the things we learned in the METOC community pretty early on. Is to expect that kind of feedback and understanding the challenges that it presents. So we're used to getting beat up, but I like to tell people at the end of the day, as a METOC officer, I'm in marketing. If you want to talk about the weather, then go talk to the chaplain. That's a different person that controls that element. I'm just here to help support what those impacts are.
Makes sense. So looking more of your background as a METOC officer, enlisted in the Navy, then now doing the LDO thing as a METOC officer, hey, want to give us a quick 3-minute bio of like what you've done in the military since joining. And I know your background. We know each other. You know, lots of different cool things you've done. But, yeah, go ahead and let the listeners know, like, your experiences up to now.
I'll try to keep it to 3 minutes. So I've been in now for – it'll be 20 years in April. So a long time around the Navy, working in various different capacities in the meteorology and oceanography community. I joined in 2004, you know, and I joined specifically to be a METOC professional, which I think kind of threw the recruiters for a little bit of a loop. They had to do a little research and figure out what METOC was. And then there was a 10-month waiting period for me to be able to join. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons why I joined. I could say, you know, it was 9/11 and the impacts that had, because it definitely played a part. But I was a young 20-year-old kid, freshly engaged with a wife. And I had to figure out how to make a living. What I was doing at the time was working as a mechanic at Tires Plus, and that just didn't seem like a viable future for me. So, you know, I looked to the military for opportunity, and it did not disappoint. So after joining in 2004, my mom had a little bit of a freak out on me. She's, you know, you're going to be in Afghanistan and Iraq. And I said, Mom, I'm a weather guy on a ship. Like, they send us in right behind the suicide squirrels. So that kind of calmed her down a little bit. But 18 months later, I was on my first deployment with a SEAL platoon in Afghanistan. So not exactly the way that I had pictured things going, but it speaks sort of to the different opportunities the military provides. When I joined, it was to be a METOC guy, but there was a pressing need in the Navy for unmanned aerial vehicle operators. And so I quickly got pulled into that program. And from that standpoint, that put me in line with Naval Special Warfare and working with those guys. I worked at Special Warfare Development Group for almost 5 years. When they picked me up, I was the youngest member of the command at 21 at the time, which was unprecedented. The average age there is 33. I was also the junior ranking guy there for a very long time, which meant that I took the trash out every day for 2 years. 3 years till we got promoted. So I definitely had my share of learning to do in that environment. And, you know, the operational pace was very high at that point. So I did multiple combat deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq and a bunch of other operations in between. I was supposed to go to airborne and get my jump wings while I was there. Three different times I got on the bus to get on the plane to go to Benning. And the third time I got on the bus and I was getting ready to go, and my chief got on the bus and he said, "Hey, Dan, you're not going." And I held on to my gear, and I was like, "You're going to have to drag me off this bus, Walt." And he said, "Okay, well, I got good news, bad news." And I said, "Okay, well, give me the good news first." And he said, "Well, we're still going to throw you out of a perfectly good airplane." And I said, "Okay, bad news is you're just not going to jump school to do it." And so I got off that bus, got on another bus, got on a C-17, flew for 20 hours, and I did my first tandem jump into the Indian Ocean. So it was an experience, you know, written stuff about how that all went down. But it just goes to show how dynamic the military is and how things can rapidly change. But after my tour there, I went to AGC school. I went and got my forecasting qualification. Decided I need a little bit of a downtime from that kind of operation tempo. And I had the opportunity to go out to Hawaii and our command patrol reconnaissance wings, and really enjoyed that. I was a leading petty officer there. By the time I left, liked the island so much, we decided to stay for another 3 years. My chief had moved to the other side of the island to work with SEAL Delivery Vehicle Team 1 outside. And so I asked him if I could go over there and join him, and he said, absolutely. And so I went over there and helped stand up their unmanned underwater vehicle program and reconstitute what they had initially started back in, you know, before 9/11. And so a really cool opportunity working with those guys, dynamic mission set. I laugh because my principal job there was doing surf forecasting. So, you know, for me to be able to say I spent 3 years in Hawaii doing nothing but surf forecasting, you know, I kind of chuckle at that because it's an awesome experience. And so commissioned out of there on board the USS Missouri, Mighty Mo, and went to LDO Academy, went back to the Fleet Weather Center in Norfolk to be a ship routing officer. In Norfolk, we control ship routing for all of the Atlantic all the way through the Mediterranean. So there's a lot of ships that we have forecasting support for. On any given day, we were writing a forecast in our, you know, our watch rotation for 80 to 120 ships. So a lot of moving pieces. We also had responsibility for hurricane support for all the installations from Texas all the way to the East Coast. So we did a lot of work with the National Hurricane Center. I forecasted for Hurricane Michael that made landfall in Panama City. Provided support for that.
Oh, nice.
Then I went somewhere completely unpredictable. I had orders to JIOC Hawaii, which is a Joint Intelligence Operation Command in Hawaii. I had hard paper copies for 10 days. I was excited about getting back to the island. And then I got a phone call from the detailer on a Thursday afternoon before I was going on leave saying, hey, Dan, I'm sending you to Surface Mine Warfare Development Center in San Diego. And the detailer was my previous OIC, so we were pretty good friends. And I didn't take the news too well initially. And so I called her on my drive down to a buddy's wedding the next day and said, hey, I'm sorry for not reacting positively to the change. And I think that was more so because I had to go home and tell my wife, hey, by the way, we're not going to Hawaii anymore. That was a little bit challenging. But went there at Surface Mine Warfare Development Center for the Mine Warfare Division for 3 years. Really worked on changing the way that we look at mine warfare as a whole. The technology that's available today and the way that things have changed and the lessons that we've learned from land warfare, mine warfare, started to become more appreciable in the undersea domain. And so I got to do a lot of work helping reorient that community in a direction that the future is taking us, regardless of how we feel about it. And before I left, I got to do some support for UCOM and do some mission planning out there for those guys and really be able to make a huge impact in UCOM AOR. So really awesome opportunity. And from there, came here to Naval Postgraduate School, where I've spent the last year working on my master's program for meteorology and oceanography. It's been its own unique set of challenges. Out of all the jobs I've done, this is the one that I am most fish out of water in. I'm not an academic student by any stretch of the imagination. I'm much more operationally focused, and so this is really challenging me on a personal level to better understand the academics that go behind the operational side. And it's been a challenging but great opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd say you probably can't have one without the other, though. Like, I'm sure you bring a lot of operational experience and a lot of anecdotes, details that perhaps in the academic environment they're aware of, but they don't know to the niche level of detail that you do to kind of have that fusion between, you know, operational impacts and the scholarly, you know, deep thinking work that we're doing here.
So my thesis is actually it's something that's not really been done before, and I didn't go the traditional route. A lot of times the professors here have a select pipeline of research that they're working on, and students will typically align with those efforts and go with the professors on things that they're currently working on. And me being the person that I am, decided to go against the grain. Anybody who knows me for any period of time knows that that's my personality. So I started working on environmental pattern of life, which is geared towards how do we start leveraging machine learning and AI in an operational sense. And so I'm looking at ship track data, looking at WaveWatch 3 wave information, and then ERA 5 model data to show 10-meter winds. Throwing those three together and then trying to figure out what's the most optimum route for ships to take in a machine learning environment or using AI to get a better understanding of how we look at how we route ships. So that's kind of where I'm traveling with this. And I got picked up for a grant from NIWC PAC to be able to do it. So huge, huge help. Great institution down there at NIWC PAC. They do a phenomenal work down there. And also working with Naval Research Labs here in Monterey as well. I have a great working relationship with them throughout my operational time. And also Fleet Numerical Oceanography Command across the street as well that do all of our modeling for the entirety of the fleet. So, you know, it's definitely stretching across multiple disciplines, multiple commands to be able to get this done.
I'm guessing the ultimate intent is to just accelerate decision making.
Yeah, anything that we can do to optimize our manpower, because, you know, there's a lot of ground to cover in the METOC community, and there's not that many of us, surprisingly. I think with officers and enlisted, we're about 1,200 total, and that fluctuates from year to year, but there's not a lot of us. And so there's a lot of work to do, not a lot of us. How do we optimize the workload so that we can get to some of the problems we haven't been able to get to?
Are you guys tied in with, like, some of the computer science professionals, like looking at this artificial intelligence machine learning model and where you can take your operational experience and kind of check the training of these AIs and make sure they're actually having good outputs to you and stuff like that?
So that's one of the things that I've been meeting with my thesis advisors about. My principal thesis advisor is Dr. Eva Renier. she's in the OR department, and so she's my principal advisor, MeTalk guy, working with an OR, you know, advisor, tying in some of the computer science folks as well. So
for those that don't know, OR people, that's like the fancy word for like math wizards here at MPS.
And she specifies in decision making, and that's kind of her field of expertise, and so that's where kind of we all blend in. But yeah, you know, the admiral here, Rondeau, has been very clear about getting work done across multiple disciplines here at MPS, including academia, Department of Defense, and also industry. So I've also reached out to industry so far. The company up in San Francisco kind of does some of the stuff that I'm looking at doing, and we have an agreement with them for research. So LinkedIn with those guys, phenomenal group up there. Those guys are doing amazing work. Also, Microsoft, they actually have a weather division, believe it or not, that's working on AI forecasting. And then OPT is another company out there as well that has some interest in collaborating as well. So a lot of moving parts, which is probably the biggest challenge that I face in this thesis, is a lot of collaboration to get this done.
I'm glad to hear that you have all that collaboration, though. I'm glad to hear that, you know, us at Naval Postgraduate School, we're tied in. We have, you know, Silicon Valley just 45 minutes up the road, up to 101. And I'm glad that you're working with the Microsoft guys and this AI project. And then another example I heard of, Professor Clay Moltz, who's from the Space Systems Operations, they work with a lot of the commercial space vendors up in San Francisco. So for those out there listening, you want to get out to Monterey and study big problems for the military, there's a plethora of resources, not just at Monterey, partnerships with Stanford, partnerships with Microsoft, et cetera. And it's great that, keep harping on it, but you know, you can take your practical on-the-ground experience, because all of these systems of systems, big acquisition projects, big technology, et cetera, there's always a guy or gal on the ground that's actually using this tool potentially in a dangerous environment, and you're able to provide that expertise to these people. One thing that me and you have talked about is you have this quote, the most dangerous place to be in a gunfight is comfortable. So can you tell us about that quote and who taught you that quote and sure. How it applies?
Sure. I was at SEAL Delivery Vehicle Team 1, standing in the quarterdeck watch one evening, and our master chief, Billy Godak, who was at DevGuru with me for a period of time, came walking in. He was Geo Bachelor on island for a year, waiting for a spot to open up back at the command so he could get back there. And he walked in on the quarter deck and he just looked at me and he goes, Dan, do you know where the most dangerous place to be in a gunfight is? And, you know, I'm looking at this crusty, very operationally experienced SEAL. And I said, I have no idea. And he said, comfortable. And that kind of hit me like a ton of bricks, because I think that's not just applicable in a gunfight. You know, as we challenge ourselves to personally develop, when we start getting comfortable with where we're at, things become dangerous because we start inherently becoming a little bit more complacent in the way that we do things. And so I've taken that to heart in a lot of ways. If I find myself in a situation where I start feeling relaxed and good, I start looking for ways to start challenging myself and you know, what am I not looking at? So I thought, you know, he had a lot of great quotes. He's a fantastic leader in general. You know, just a quick anecdote to that. When I knew him back at DevGuru, I had a son, and he said to me, hey, Dan, he's coming on island to visit for a little bit. You mind if he comes hangs out with you guys in the Intel shop? And I said, sure, yeah, no problem. You know, I've known this kid for a while. And he shows up and walks into our N2 spaces, and it's IS2 Godak, you know, and that kind of hit me too. It's like, oh, man, I'm no longer the young guy on the block here.
I knew you when you were this tall and exactly. In uniform.
Yeah, exactly. Now you're towering over me, you know. He's a big guy. But, yeah, that's in the military, you go through those experiences. You know, another guy I worked with at SDV Team 1, his last name was Fennessy, and I walked up to him. And I'm like, hey, do you have a brother that was in? And he's like, no, I don't have a brother. And I was like, oh, okay. He's like, my dad was in. It's like, oh, that hurt. So I knew his dad. I worked with his dad as ET when we were at DevGuru together too. So like I said, I've been around for 20 years. So, you know, you start seeing kids of the people that you've worked
crossing generations now. Yeah. Looking at family, I'm glad you brought that up. When I was listening to you go through your whole like military timeline, I'm just thinking, I thought of two things. One, you're like the key example of the worst that they can say is no when looking for different opportunities and taking different opportunities. But that also makes you a very busy person, I imagine. And you were married before your first enlisted and went off to boot camp. You were married. So how have you been able to strike that work-life balance, family, you know, family time, work time, et cetera?
You know, it's a great question. If you've been in the military for any given point in time, hats off to the families, first and foremost. You know, when I first joined and immediately found myself in a position of deploying to combat zones with the teams, you know, I had to leave my wife behind, you know, and communications weren't what they are today. I'd get a SAT phone call every 2 weeks to kind of talk to her about different things. On my second deployment, you know, I looked at a house. She bought it, did all the renovations, did all the work. You know, she'd send me pictures of paint swaps and say, what do you think about this in this room? And, you know, we'd have conversations. But it was really challenging for her because every time something came across the news, it was always a case of, oh, God, is that Dan, you know? And that's challenging. But, you know, I got to say, you know, the greatest strength I have is my family because they're incredible. They enable me to be able to do the things that I do for the Department of Defense. And making people say no is something I'm very good at. I will continually find, you know, questions that require answers. And sometimes the answer is no. And sometimes it's, hey, that needs work. Go do it, you know. And if you want to make meaningful impact and change, you have to be open to that kind of mindset to be able to find things and do them more efficiently or do them in a different way that benefits the force. And I looked at Grace Hopper as kind of one of my great heroes. She had a couple of quotes, and one of them was, the most dangerous phrase in the English language is because it's always been done that way. Mm-hmm. And the other quote that she has that's pretty meaningful to me is, sometimes it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. And I've operated a lot that way in my military career, and I'd be lying if I didn't say sometimes that gets me in trouble. But if I feel like I'm doing the right thing, then I'm going to push out and do it. And, you know, I have to live with the consequences of those actions. So a lot of times people say, well, you're just a lieutenant. And, you know, I kind of smile because even as a second class, I still remember sitting in a room with a Joint Chief of Staff when they're talking about decision making and them turning to me and asking my expert opinion on a specific thing. And it was kind of like that sum of all fears moment with Morgan Freeman and Ben Affleck. They're walking into the briefing room and Morgan Freeman pulls Ben Affleck aside and he's the analyst. And he says, look, there are two things you need to know in this meeting. I'm paraphrasing. One is, if you know the answer, say it. If you don't, shut up, you know. And it was very much a surreal moment like that to be able to sit in that room full of caliber decision makers and as a second class and have an operational impact on what was happening. So it doesn't matter your pay grade. It doesn't really. It comes from personal desire and motivation to make a change. And sometimes it's harder because you're swimming upstream and you got to get decision makers to make decisions. We talked about that before the podcast kind of came on. But every time that I've done something that's meaningful, it's taken a lot of effort. And that's my key takeaway. If it's worthwhile doing it, it takes work. And that takes support from your family at home to be able to enable you to do that. It is challenging to do that balance, though.
Speaking on, you know, the grass is always greener. Some people look at us at Naval Postgraduate School saying, oh, you must have a lot of time to, you know, spend time with your family, go golfing, you're on the beach, et cetera. More power to those people because, you know, I was one of them up till I came here a year ago, grinding away in the Fleet Marine Force and supporting establishment looking over here. But every place has its unique challenges. At the end of the day, all of the active duty personnel, reserve personnel, we're all warfighters here at MPS contributing to warfighting in a unique way. So what are some of the unique challenges that you faced, you know, recently while undertaking your research here at MPS? What are some of the pros and cons that you've seen about being what they call us, warrior scholar? Not the biggest fan of that name, but warrior scholar is what they call us here. Yeah, what are some of the pros and cons that you've seen here?
I think it's great that you bring up, you know, a lot of people have said that this is a great time to kind of focus on your family. And I think for me, that's been my greatest lesson that I've learned here is that balance, is how much effort do I need to put in to accomplish the task at hand, and then how much time can I spend with my family and push off some of those things that I could work harder and get an A+, you know. So trying to find that middle ground has been a great opportunity here at MPS. To all those who are like, yeah, you're going to enjoy golfing and your free time and all that stuff, it's humbling to me because I've had to work very hard, and I know that academics is my limitation. And so for those people who, you know, have the ability to pick this stuff up quickly, you know, hats off to them, because I'm not that guy. I am the lowest common denominator in my cohort. So it's been a big challenge from that standpoint. As far as warrior scholars go, just because you're here at MPS doesn't mean that the Department of Defense doesn't need you. Just because you're here at MPS doesn't mean that your job is to be a student. You know, every Tuesday we put on a uniform, and it states our branch on it. It doesn't say student. you know. And so there's been a number of times here at MPS where, you know, I get phone calls about operational stuff that are going on because of my background or expertise. And it's flattering that people still want to hear my opinion on things that are happening in, around the globe today. So you still have that military hat that you wear, even though you're here as a student. So, you know, I guess that's the warrior part of being a scholar.
Just one last question. We're just under 30 minutes, and you know, thanks a lot for your time. Glad we're able to schedule this. Me and Dan have actually been trying to schedule this for about 2 months now. So for those that say, oh, hey, those Marine sailors are at Naval Postgraduate School working on their golf game, going to the beach. Like, we're in a cool location, but lots of dynamic stuff going on. So glad we could get this finally scheduled, man. And so you have your thesis that you're studying. Obviously, you have pulse on a lot of what they call wicked problems that the DoD is dealing with. If you could name one thing that through your time here at MPS and through your 20 years in the Navy, so you've seen a lot of problem sets and issues that the DoD is addressing. If we had Chief of Naval Operations in here, Secretary Austin, and you could tell him one problem that isn't being looked at right now, what would that problem set be?
There's a lot of them out there that I think are key. It's hard to narrow it down to just one specific problem set. But if I were to say one thing that I think we could do a better job on, they're already aware of, it's the talent management aspect of how we bring our abilities to the fight. You know, we talked briefly about how pay grade doesn't matter. You know, as a force, there's still discipline that's required. There's still day-to-day jobs that need to be done. So, you know, the challenge is really how do you balance those skill sets of some of these junior sailor, airmen, Marines that are coming in with incredible capability, and how do you bring them into a problem set to be able to kind of accelerate to an answer? And, you know, I think we could do better as a force at pushing things down from the senior levels and letting junior people kind of step in and come up with creative, innovative ideas and empower them in the decision-making process. And I think if we can get a little bit better at that, I think it'll solve a lot of the retention issues that, you know, the Department of Defense has kind of been facing. It also, I think there's a lot of the greatest marketing we have are people who are getting out, whether it be retirement or other ambitions. And so they're the gatekeepers at the end of the day. And if they walk out of the military, the bad experience, they go tell their friends, and then there's 10 people who didn't join, you know. And so empowering our junior sailors to be able to be a part of the decision-making process to help problem solve, I think provides ownership that will help get a better feeling when they leave the force, that they contributed and they were a part and they were, you know, critical to the success of the mission. So that's the one thing I think we could probably do better on as a force, talent management.
Definitely agree. Talent management's a key thing, I think, in all the services. A lot of our key leaders coming out with a lot of strategic documents talking about it, which I've been in for 20 years. I've been in for about 12-ish years. It hasn't always been a day-to-day topic, so I'm glad that it's being talked about, socialized. And, you know, it's a journey, not a destination. We'll never completely figure it out, but as long as we're thinking about it and taking care of the people that we work around, we'll be fine, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I stand in awe at a lot of our junior sailors, airmen, and Marines that come into the force. They are so capable. They are so incredibly talented. They're doing things as they come in that I dreamed I could have done, you know, 15 years ago, that I dreamed that I could do now. They just have an incredible set of skills that they bring to the problem. They have a very innovative way of approaching problem sets that, you know, people like me who've been institutionalized for 20 years, you know, I don't always offer the most fresh perspective because I've been staring at the problems for so long. And so it's very unique. My son is in robotics, you know, middle schooler, and he outcodes me every day of the week. There's no two ways about it. And his unique way of looking at problems and how he does that through coding and technology is just phenomenal.
Yeah, awesome. Well, Dan, I know you got to head over to the library and do some work. I got to go type a paper myself. So work is never done. That's also a journey, not a destination.
Thanks for your time. I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot
for your time as well. Have a good day.
Thanks for joining us in the Trident Room. For more information about today's guests and topics, please visit the show notes online at nps.edu/Trident Room Podcast. The Trident Room Podcast has been brought to you by the Naval Postgraduate School Alumni Association and Foundation. For questions, comments, and suggestions, please email us at TridentRoomPodcastHost@nps.edu.